Hello, friends and listeners. This is Spencer Dillehay here, your faithful narrator, with some big news about The Drop for Season 3. The prologue, which introduces a new character and is called Cougar, will release in 2 weeks on April 28th. And then after that, Season 3, Episode 1, debuts on Monday, May 5th. Klaus and I want to thank you all so much for all your support and listenership over the past couple years, and we look forward to seeing you there. Now, hang around and listen to the interview between Klaus and I, and then two pieces of Tempest Investigations fiction will follow. Enjoy. Hello, Tempest fans. My name is Spencer Dillehay, and I am joined today by Klaus Holm. I am the narrator for Tempest, and Klaus is the author. Say hello, Klaus.
Hi, guys. Hi, guys. Nice to meet you. Nice to be here today.
We wanted to get together to chat a little bit at the end of season two and share some behind-the-scenes type stuff in keeping with the TV series style of the books. We thought it would be fun to do some behind the scenes in actors interview type situation. So Here we are. We've prepared a couple of questions for one another, and we'll just have an informal dialogue and hang out. And then correct me if I'm wrong, but we're also going to add in at the end of our discussion some of the fan fiction.
Exactly, because we have actually gotten fan fiction. I know I've asked you guys to send me, and someone did send me fan fiction. And it's really good. It was amazing to be able to read someone else's take on one of the characters and tell a completely separate story from the main story. And so I promised her that we would read it on the air, and Suspense is going to do it. I'm promising it's going to be canon completely, but it's there. It's there, and it's really good.
You know, this isn't one of the questions I have prepared for you, but what does it feel like? And I'm sad that this is never a joy that I will know, but what does it feel like as an author to have someone writing in your universe?
It is the best.
It's got to feel good.
Yeah. It felt amazing. I've had it happen twice. Once in a story, a series of books I've written in Danish, my native language, Danish. And then once here with Tempest. And it's amazing because it feels like you're seeing your characters through someone else's eyes.
Right.
You're hearing them talk to you, but it's a different voice all
yes,
of a sudden.
They're
it's
the
a different
same, but
angle.
Different.
And it really feels good. It's the most sincere form of flattery, completely. I mean, I was blown away by it, and especially by this young reader who's I don't want to say how old and young she is, but she was quite young. And I think it was amazing that she had such a grasp of the character.
I agree. And I'll preface this also by saying, or maybe finish this idea by saying, you know, I worry that some people think that if they write fan fiction and send it to the author, that the author's going to be pissed. But the opposite is true for you.
I know someone will. I mean, I'm sure if you send it to J.K. Rowling, I'm sure she'd be pissed.
Well, it depends on what we do with the characters, I guess. I know certainly she has some hot button issues that she feels strongly about, but that's fair. I mean, you know, Disney keeps a tight rein on Mickey Mouse, but yeah.
But I think most people would love it.
I think so
most people
too.
Would be flattered by it.
Because I think you're right. You have the choice about how to take it. You know, I believe, like you do, that it's a beautiful, you know, sense of flattery. And it's also great to experience the characters from someone else's eyes. I guess someone could take it a weird direction and feel like, get off my territory, man. Like, this is my thing. Get the hell out of here. Get your own universe. But I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah. We're all here to have fun, you know?
Right.
Let's play. Let's play in the same yard for a while. I think that's the greatest thing to do. So I hope you will enjoy what she wrote for us later on.
Now, would you like to start or shall I?
You can go ahead and start.
Okay. Okay. I have a couple of questions that I think some listeners will be interested to hear the answers to. And the big one on everybody's mind. Is so What made you decide to write Tempest in the structure that you did as a TV series instead of, like, you know, just a chapter-based episodic thing?
Well, first of all, when I started writing it, I did some notes about this in book three, in the DVD extras in the book three. But when I started writing Tempest Investigations, it was actually just one story. It was a short story, the first chapter of book one. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know there was going to be more. I thought, I'll put this in a short story collection and it'll be fun and see how people react. And then it kept, because I used some characters from a role-playing game that we were using, and I sort of stretched them and I fiddled with them and I changed them a little bit around so they would work in fiction instead of just in the RPG world. But I didn't know there was going to be more. But then I started getting more ideas. And I said, mm-hmm. okay, well, we should introduce this other character that was also in the game. How about we put him in? Uh-huh. And then suddenly I had it was too long. And I said, okay, I'm going to have to put this in a book by itself. Wow. But it was four different stories at that point. And so I said, why don't we make this into – because I always imagined it in my head as being played out like a TV series. Because yeah. I started writing the first story as a fan fiction kind of story, where I always said, well, if I write fan fiction and I describe the bridge of the Enterprise, mm-hmm. you'd say, well, get on with it, man, because I know what the bridge of the Enterprise looks like.
Right.
And so if I start writing this book and I say, well, I expect you all to know what a guy with a sword looks like, or with a private investigator with a fedora hat on. How does he look in San Francisco? Well, you can probably figure it out yourself. You know it already. Mm-hmm. And that's why I sort of assumed that the reader would know that. And I try to see how will that work if you write an entire story and then an entire book mm-hmm. like that. And it was a really fun way to write, very different from how I normally write.
You know, when I started in on Tempest, it struck me suddenly that it was such a fun and interesting idea to structure it like a serialized TV series. I was shocked that I hadn't really encountered anybody else doing that.
There's one guy. I had a conversation with a guy online who came out and he said, "This my book is the first series TV series in book form." And I said, "No. Sorry, dude, but I wrote mine first."
Well, actually, I have beat you to the punch.
but doing that was, that's the only two I've ever heard of.
That's wild, right? Yeah. Doesn't that seem like an idea that should have come up 30 years ago?
I know.
Maybe it has. You know, I must profess ignorance on that. I have not read all the books. So no, I'm sure, you know, it could be out there. But especially... I actually didn't know that it was a short story collection at first, but it makes total sense then to sort of retcon it into a TV series because that follows. That's what TV series are. They're a bunch of short stories, you know, that somebody wrote for the screen.
Exactly.
So I'm even more surprised that nobody has stumbled upon the idea of structuring their short story collection in this way. But I guess most short story collections don't have the same characters.
No. That's the whole thing. That's the whole thing.
So you've touched upon a couple of things. For number three, I wanted to visit the TTRPG inspiration, but let's circle that into number two because you mentioned it.
Yeah.
So I've made it through season three. I've recorded it. You know, it's done. And there's some postscript material, the DVD extras that you mentioned. And in those, you said that some of the characters were... their inspirations were born in a TTRPG tabletop role-playing game called White Wolf.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about, like, how did these characters originate and then change when they went from TTRPG to Tempest?
Well, one of the changes was simply because I couldn't steal from
that would be foul. Property foul.
Because Jim Corrigan was originally a Highlander. He was an immortal that lived a long, long time, just like Connor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod in Highlander. And so he was immortal, and he knew he was immortal. And he was trained by another immortal, just like in Highlander.
Yes, the similarities stack up. I'm sensing it would have been an issue.
And that's, I figured, you know what, this is not going to work if I do it as my own fiction. I can't just claim to steal someone else's property, intellectual property. And we had a character who was a wizard, and we had a character who was a demon hunter. And a lot of it was also crypt. Yeah, it was really cool party. And a lot of it was crypt from Buffy, actually. Buffy and Angel, which we were really into at the time, was pulled into that. And that's also a part of where the episodic structure came from, because you have Buffy and Angel, you have like the season Big Bad, and you have every episode sort of a standalone story.
Yes.
Even though you're still following the main characters and the main plot. So we had a lot of those things, and it worked really well when we were playing it, but it wouldn't work when I started writing it. And because I sat down and I said, well, I'm going to start with this. The first story in book one is called How Like a Fallen Angel. And I didn't want to put too many characters in it, because I could see this is going to be much more interesting if we focus on Jim Corrigan himself as the main character. But I still needed someone to come in and help him out. And so I picked our NPC in the party, which was our secretary, Mercedes Perez. And she came in and she just rocked the whole book completely in a better direction, because suddenly Jim had someone to talk to that he could be his foil and say, I'm going to go do this now. And she says, okay, are you sure about that? Because that's probably stupid. Oh, okay.
By the way,
so you have someone to talk to all the time.
To the DM, sorry to cut you off, but it's amazing that to put one of the NPCs as the secretary for the party is like a pretty master stroke, I feel like. Because the DM can still exercise some agency in there and like participate with you guys.
And the worst thing is that when we actually played it, she was not even a planned NPC. She was a character. She was a waitress in a restaurant that our characters ate in. In the first scenario we ever played, and one of our characters decided that she needed saving because this whole town was going to hell and people were dying. She said, "We're going to have to save the waitress. So I'm going to go save the waitress."
So, but then
take her out of town.
That is her origin story in Tempest.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I changed it a little bit around. It's been tweaked a little bit. And that's why I always end up apologizing to my players. I thank them in the books, but I always say, whatever you guys did, I know you did this, but I've changed so much from what they had originally put on the page and other character sheets that they are more my creations now than they were back then.
That's wicked. And you can tell, too, that... You know, it does not feel like you are writing against a script of what Jim was. It does feel like he has the chance to grow and change over the course, which is necessary, obviously, three seasons in. Mm-hmm. We can't be talking about the exact same guy. That would be kind of stale. So he changes and we get to explore different aspects of his personality. So I dig it. Yeah, I can see the writer's hand in these changes. Now, so much of our story takes place in San Francisco. I was curious if you had, you know, there's a lot of details in there that seem pretty specific. They could have been Googled, but do you have, is there any connection?
I actually went there. When I started out writing the story, it was actually to separate it a little bit from Buffy and Angel. Like I said, we were inspired by, but that takes place in Southern California, Los Angeles and Sunnydale.
Yeah,
and
right.
I wanted to do something different. I didn't want to do New York, which was like, you know, for all the Marvel things happening. And
right.
I wanted to do something different. And so San Francisco was a cool town. I figured, okay, I supposed to be very laid back, supposed to be a place where you could be yourself, and you know, free of everything. Why not say that's where the supernaturals go to be free as well, and be, you know, take it easy, hang out.
But I, so she just, I dig, yeah. Well, now I feel like I got to circle back around, but I dig the idea that San Fran is like this, and this comes out in season three, I think. I'm not going to, I have to remind myself not to talk about it, because as of this recording, it has not aired on the podcast. But I won't say much more than that, other than that becomes evident more soon, is all I feel like I can say.
Dig and it. I can actually say I changed something a little bit, because in my original idea for Jim as well, and when I started writing book one, was that there were no longer like really any vampires of note in San Francisco, because they were so afraid of Jim that they just left town. And I figured, and later on, I figured, no, that's not how it works. He would not have that kind of relationship with an entire class of supernatural beings. You know, they'd end up being a live and let live.
But, I mean, that would be extraordinarily badass.
Yeah. But I figured that's not going to work. So that's why in book three, we're having, I suppose, if you even looked at the cover, you can see that's about vampires. But I actually went to San Francisco. So I actually went between book two and book three. I went to San Francisco because I figured I needed to, like you said, most of it had been Googled. I had been doing Google Earth, and I had found different places that I wanted to use. But I wanted to see everything in real life. I wanted to live and breathe the city that Jim Corrigan and his friends lived in. And so I went there for a little over 2 weeks, and I spent time. I lived in the Mission, just down the street from where Mercedes's apartment was supposed to be. And I walked around San Francisco for days and days and days. The guy I lived with said, "You're absolutely nuts, because why don't we just take the subway, or you take a taxi?" I'm like, "No, I want to walk. I want to see what it's like to walk in San Francisco." And I got into some really funky shit in San Francisco, because there's a place called the Tenderloin, which is not a good place to be. It's like the really bad part of town. Yeah, it sounds nice, but it's a really bad part of town. And I didn't know that was supposed to be like literally right off of Market Street. Right, you turn one corner and you're in the bad place. And suddenly I turn down the wrong corner and I find myself in this utter junky neighborhood with people shooting up on the street. Wow. Prostitutes standing in the doorways, you know, half naked. And looking at me, and I absolutely, nope, it was like that. It was literally where I felt, I don't belong here. And then the only thing I could think about was, I gotta summon my inner Jim Corrigan, man, because I have to figure out a way to walk out of here without anyone suspecting that I am weak or easy prey. And so I turned around and I walked out. I got away scot-free, but I was actually quite scared at that point.
Oh man.
So I figured I should have some questions for you as well, Spencer. So I want to know, I mean, obviously you were the second reader. There's a further reader that read book one.
Yes.
Called Neil Heligers. And then you came in and did book two and book three. So what was it like taking over in midstream like that? How did you find the characters in it?
You know, it's both easy and difficult, and it's sort of it can be a weird position to be in as a voice actor, as a narrator, because, you know, the questions that come up is like, okay, well, what happened to the other guy? I don't want to even call it out or anything, but like, you know, I mean, I came back for two. You would have been a narrator eater if you got a different guy for three.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, the advantage of it is that somebody has already they've done the hard work in book one of figuring out more or less who the characters are. The tricky part is I don't feel like I can deviate very far when they've been established, because you run the risk of pissing off the audience. It's got to be a relatively smooth transition. I've read a whole lot of reviews where people are pissed when the narrator changes midstream.
Yeah.
We haven't gotten too much of that, which I appreciate. Thank you to those listeners who, you know, appreciate my voice. But I think it was a pretty easy transition. I hope that it wasn't too jarring.
I don't think it was jarring. I think it was actually, first of all, let me say that I think you did a fantastic job on recording these books.
Thank you.
You have but that goes without saying, I should say, because I think that's why we're here today. But I also want to say that you caught those characters so well that there was I don't think anyone really had any issues with it. And even if they did had issues with it, if someone had told me that, I would have said, well, it's like a television show. You have different directors
right.
for every episode. And so the same characters might be a little different sometimes. You might see them in a little bit of different light sometimes because the director has changed and he has a different vision. And now we have a different vision coming out with the voices, and it's a different take.
I love that way of looking at it, especially with Tempest as a new director. Or, you know, what would I be, a production manager? I don't know who I would be who has that type of influence. But yes, you're absolutely right. That's a very kind way to look at it, which I appreciate. It's not like there's a stranger in season two.
No.
This new guy sucks.
Not at all. And I can tell you that the first time that the first reader, when he did it, he contacted me and he said, there's some things that I don't like to do in the reading. And he said, what's that? He said, well, I don't like that I have to make a Mexican voice for Mercedes. I don't have to do an accent for her. And he said, well, I think you really should, because this is how she sounds inside my head.
Yeah.
And so she said, okay. So he did it. And then I think we had a conversation about something similar where you also said, well, isn't it kind of stereotypical to do this or that? And I said, well, it works because this is how the character sounds.
You know, both, I'm sure it's interesting to know that both he and I may have had the same sort of fear. Is it's not so much, speaking from my point of view, it isn't so much that, like, there's a fear that lives in my head as an audiobook narrator of doing a caricature. And it's it's nothing I would do on purpose, obviously, but I'm just petrified of, you know, shocking people out of the story, or even worse than that, making them feel disrespected.
Yeah.
And I never got that was ever in the text. But, you know, I don't know. If you listen to audiobooks, you may have heard people take a crack at, like, men doing women's voices. There's a frequent complaint that all the girls will sound like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's shocking and kind of shitty. Like, is that what you think girls sound like, guy? Yeah. Or the opposite is true as well. I've heard some women doing males' voices like this.
Yeah, exactly.
This is not how we talk to each other, I'm afraid. So, you know, I don't know. And it gets worse, too, with when you think of, like, okay, English is not, you know, Mercedes. Well, actually, she's a special case. I think she probably grew up bilingual, as many people in Southern California do. But, you know, if I was trying to do somebody whose first language was not English, I would worry about disrespecting them by sounding like a shitty American who doesn't like, you know, foreigners. Hey, you British people all sound like this, don't you? Or, you know, screwing up accents or whatever. I think that's where our hesitation came from. And then compounded that Mercedes is a female. So we're stretching it even a little bit further. Okay, I have to figure out what, you know, where to put her voice. What does she look like? What does she look like physically? And then on top of that, I have to make sure that I try to get as authentic as possible without hedging into, you know, somebody who actually has that accent hearing me and saying, oh God, that's awful.
You can see someone like when you're doing Anderson Kramer has a very exaggerated, and he intends to overact his accent. He has a very ghetto accent for the character that he plays, a very, like, laid back hippie 70s voice. for the persona that he gives off, and then he doesn't sound like that at all when he is himself.
I love
but you could say, well,
doing that type
when you,
of stuff.
Yeah. And when you have that voice, that's that, you know, Shaft voice, basically, you know, you could say, oh, this sounds disrespectful, but yeah, but it's the guy in the book being disrespectful. Yeah. It's actually, you know, it's not the reader, it's not the narrator. It's actually the character trying to be, you know, pretend to be something he's not.
Those types of characters are a lot of fun because I feel like it's like a free pass to kind of do something not as well, or like, you know, people are more familiar often with the stereotypes of other people. And when it's obvious that you're not supposed to like a character, of course, this is not the case with Anderson, you weren't immediately sure. But sometimes you're not supposed to like the character. The character's being shitty, and they're putting on this affect, so it can be kind of self-lampooning in a way that is a lot of fun to perform.
If we could circle back to, because I have a second question, sort of leads into what you said before about how to imagine Mercedes physically when you're doing her voice, for instance. And I was wondering, now that you've read the DVD extras in book three, you'll see that I give out my vision, my version of how I think the characters, they look. I say, this is the actor that I see pretending to, when I see him in my head, this is the character that's playing the part.
Yes.
How was that different for you? Do you have, like, did you agree with me when you saw that? Who was playing them? Or did you have a
pull it up and talk about it in detail? Of course, I can't remember exactly, you know, who was cast, but I do remember in some cases being like, huh, for some of them. Although, you know what might be kind of fun? Do you remember? Maybe we should cast them. Although, you know what? I don't know that I know actors well enough to pick who would play Jim. And I think you had a couple, like a mashup.
I had originally imagined him as a George Clooney character.
Too suave, but then, for me.
And then later on, when I saw Firefly on TV, and I saw Nathan Fillion.
Oh, he would be great.
And I said, that is how he looks. This is Jim, exactly to the point.
Jim.
The way that he looked in Firefly, that was how Jim looked in my head. And that, from that moment on, that's how he looked.
I think I can get behind that. You know, if we maybe, I don't know, if Jim's not super like buff or anything, but I imagine him being at least kind of stocky, you know, able to defend himself. He must in his line of work. But I think Nathan Fillion would be great. Although I think people could make an argument that he's almost too charming to play Jim. Jim has some hard edges at times.
He does, but that's why I liked him in Firefly, because he's not very charming a lot of the time in Firefly. And that's how I saw him, as being, you know, kind of an ass some of the time.
Yes. Oh, man. Great show, by the way. If you all haven't seen Firefly, it's out of the pop culture now. It's, I guess it's gone to almost cult status, but you got to check it out. I don't know where you can watch it, but that show is great. And you can see alternate universe Jim.
Exactly. And I had, for Andrew, I had always seen him as like a young Brad Pitt.
I was surprised about Andrew. That was one where I was like, well, damn. I hadn't really thought
of him.
At first, I had imagined him, because he's coming in from the FBI, right? Yes. He's out. He's not in anymore.
But no.
I'd imagined him. Have you ever seen, and I didn't know this at the time, as I had not seen Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Twin Peaks?
I have seen Twin Peaks, yes.
So there is an FBI agent in Twin Peaks who I don't think is quite like Andrew in retrospect, but I'd imagined a more clean-cut character. This is until he got on his motorcycle, and then my physical idea of him changed. I was like, oh, shit. Okay, well, Dale Cooper is not riding a motorcycle, Dale Cooper being the agent from Twin Peaks. And he also doesn't have any of the same type of mannerisms. But when I first encountered the character, I'd imagined him as a little bit more analytical. maybe buy the books isn't the right word, but like I thought he was going to be the deductive type to complement Jim. And they do work together well like that, but he's by the end. Oh, I can't talk about season three. But by the end, I imagined him. He was a little bit more tougher. I saw him more as some muscle as well. Yeah. So I guess I could see a Brad Pitt, although I think he's maybe a little taller and thinner than.
He is, yes.
Maybe these days Brad Pitt is thinned down, but I'm thinking like, was he in Troy? He was freaking jacked in the 2000s.
Yeah.
But that was one where I was like, well, damn, huh? You know who else might be able to play him?
Who would
a younger, have? Let me see here. I'd imagined him as a little bit younger Matt Damon. Brown
that
hair.
Could work. Yeah.
He played Jason Bourne. I think he could pull off a sort of less action-y FBI agent, maybe.
He could have done it. He could have done it, I think, yeah. Although Andrew is blonde.
Indeed. We would have had to dye his hair. I imagined him very clean and, whatever. Sort of unremarkable at first. But then again, pictures of characters often take shape as the books go on in my mind.
That's true. And Mercedes, I had cast as Vanessa Hudgens when she was very young, when she did High School Musical.
Oh, you know what? I don't know. What does young Vanessa look like?
If you go in and you find online and you find a picture from High School Musical, that's exactly what she looks like.
Oh, here we go. I'll just type in high school. I'm at my computer, of course, so I can immediately pull it up. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, I don't think no notes. No notes on Mercedes.
No notes from there. And I found out later on that obviously she sings really well, Vanessa Hudgens. She also done a lot of different musicals. She did Grease and all that other stuff. And I always thought, oh man, if Mercedes could sing, it would be awesome.
Oh, that would make me so anxious if I had to perform that.
I wouldn't ask you to, don't worry.
I would have to retreat behind my constant bulwark, which is like, well, if there's no IP, we can't sing anything because we'll get in trouble. And also I just like can't do it.
And then Feline, I had cast as a very, very young, Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, that works for me too.
She has this very cat-like face. Mm-hmm. I always figured cat-like eyes. And the way she moves, or at least moved when she was really young, was very much how I imagined Feline looking.
Yeah, I think I can see that for sure, too. And I think she would have been a great Feline.
And then we have Bob, which I said in my notes here, was always pictured as Channing Tatum painted red.
Now, that one surprised me, too. Let me pull up a picture of Channing Tatum. I don't know why that surprised me. I mean, I'm looking at it, and I can sell myself on it for sure. I'm not sure how I imagined Bob. I didn't have, like, an actor cast. But let's see, if we paint him red...
But you did an amazing voice for Bob. Let me tell you that when you caught him... quite early on in the book, and I thought, oh, this is amazing. This was absolutely spot on, perfect voice for that character.
I was lucky to be able to build off of, season one. I think he appears briefly, doesn't he? Yeah, he does.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
So I was able to like, oh, okay, wow, that's the direction they went. I can read his mannerisms from the page, thanks to you. So I appreciate it. I'm glad to hear that because he was a lot of fun to play.
He's one of my favorite characters.
To hit them.
He's one of my favorite characters, actually, to write because he was so much fun to, even though he doesn't get to do a lot. He does take action in book two when he joins them in the spirit world, but he's not an action character.
I was sort of like, what is he doing here? But it makes sense. But also, wow, I can't believe we get Bob in this, getting his hands dirty.
Yeah. And he doesn't like to do it. Very obviously, he's very against it, very against actually taking violent action, but he has to get someone, has to, you know, get some payback for what he had to do. If you've read the book by now, you know why.
In retrospect, as I'm thinking, I'd imagined Bob as more of a slinkier, more seductive charmer type. When I look at Channing Tatum, I think of him as more actiony, just because he has sort of Hollywood good looks. But you know, as I think about it a little harder, somebody who runs a bar for a supernatural bar has got to be ready to go.
Oh yeah,
and he does have a shotgun back there. Isn't that right? Yeah, he's got a shotgun.
He's got a shotgun. Produces. Yeah.
So, you know, it's Channing's growing on me as Bob. I'll call him once we're done and see if he's interested.
Yeah. And last but not least, and this was the easiest casting, because back when we played the RPG, this was the character that we said, the actor that we said played her, and that was Rhea Weston. She's played by Terry Farrell when she was on Star Trek Deep Space Nine back in the day, because she was just the exact person that we said, oh, this is how she has to look. She has to have this, like, she's very tall, she's dark-haired, she has these amazing eyes, very high cheekbones. And she has a great sense of humor. And so I thought, this is exactly how she needs to look.
I think that's more or less how I'd imagined her as well. Mm-hmm.
And she would actually be taller than Jim if it was still Nathan Fillion playing him.
Indeed, she would.
You know, she is super tall.
Thought about that, but she's, you know, she... Didn't she do, I could be mixing things up, but what she was doing some heists previously, yes?
Didn't her
old life before she met the Tempest crew?
Oh yeah, Rhea did, yes. Rhea was a master thief.
Indeed.
For years and years before she joined up with the good guys.
So I could imagine somebody who's, you know, tall and has some reach, creeping, of course, she doesn't need to creep anywhere, really, but,
no,
you know, moving around silently in the shadows. I could see it. I dig it. That's how I was seeing her in my mind as well.
So it sounds like we were actually quite close on a lot of the characters. I think that's positive, because that means that they came out written well enough that you could pick up on them.
If the vision is the same for us, at least... Mostly, I think it's probably a good thing. I agree. I try to train myself to pick up on lots of these details so that I can form a good image. But, you know, like you said, or like we started to say earlier, the physical aspects of the character are crucial. I have to know, you know, how they carry themselves. Are they confident? How tall? How heavy? How old? How whatever? All that stuff needs to come through in their voices when they're speaking.
Exactly. And when we're speaking of voices, that brings me to my third and last question here to you. And that is, because where I come from, I live in Denmark. I'm sure some of you who listen to this might think I might be American. I am not American. I am actually from Denmark.
People will be surprised. I live in Denmark.
People will be surprised. I know people usually are. And that's because I can speak with an American accent. But in Denmark, when you listen to audiobooks, it's become a fad now. Like these last few years, 4 or 5 years, audiobooks has really hit Denmark, but it took them all this time to get there. It was something that was for blind people and for people who were dyslexic and everything like that, and so they were always or almost always read exceptionally boring.
Oh no. Like
flat, emotionless, nothing at all.
That's so strange.
And it was horrible to listen to, but you did it anyway, because it was the only way you could read a book by listening to it. It was if you got these books that was read out loud. And it wasn't like really good actors who did it. It was a lot of the times it was actually like the same five different actors who did every book.
Wow.
And there's a few, they started doing a few, like I remember when Harry Potter started coming out on audiobook about 10, 15 years ago. they had an actual actor, Jesper Christensen, who's also an international famous actor. He read them, and he actually did a decent job, not a Stephen Fry job, but a decent job of, you know, giving it some life.
He didn't crush it, but yeah,
he did okay. But I was thinking, I listened to a couple of other books that you have read, and you don't sound like you do a lot of like the flat narration type of reading.
Yeah.
But when you approach a book, have you ever been asked by someone to do like to go flatter, to do like a more?
Could you tone it down?
That's what I mean. If it's narration, do you still try to like enliven it, or have you ever been told to keep this a little bit toned down?
I have not. Yet. I've had lots of notes on characters, and I've had my delivery adjusted where it was necessary. I guess the closest thing I've ever played to a flat delivery was intentional, because the main character and narrator is a sociopath. And so I needed to dial out some of the emotion that comes into my voice naturally when I'm speaking, because this character doesn't experience the world that way. It's flatter for them. They experience it as, oh, this happened. I should respond in this way. Not emotionless, but like, oh, I'm 1 degree removed from the feeling of what's happening around me.
Yeah. That makes sense, though.
It made sense. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't so much that like the author was like, hey, I don't like all this like acting you're doing, which you could just read it straight. I think actually the opposite is true, where at least in the States and in the groups that I'm in, people are trying their best to move away from and to learn how to read with more vibrance. Because I think the barrier of entry to audiobooks has gone down, which is great, but it also means that people who haven't really trained much on, like, you know, I don't know how to do it convincingly, you just get a mic and you start going. But a lot of that is like a straight read, where they don't put a lot of punch into the characters, and the sentences are being read almost as if just to convey the information of what's happening. Yeah. And I'm not criticizing that, but I will say that taking a little bit of leeway is not the right word, but a little bit of performative storytelling has never steered me wrong. And I think most of the authors that I work with appreciate that type of read more than perhaps the old Danish style, and also the old American style. I think it was like that too for a long time, where you don't put on voices. It was not like you were listening to a TV show. It was like you were.
And it's still there. There are still audiobooks out there like that. I am an Audible fanatic. I get a new audiobook every month, and I listen to a new audiobook every month, or sometimes more. And there are some of them out there who are absolutely boring to listen to, and even good authors too. I mean, I had one by Dean Koontz, who is not a bad author.
No way.
And it was so boring that I had to turn it off.
DNF, Dean Koontz. That's crazy. Yes. I'm surprised to hear that. I always imagined, you know, the folks in the upper echelon. But you know what? I'll say this. I think you're absolutely right. I'm pleased to be in the indie space much more than I am working with big pubs, because I feel like I have more room to perform on these indie books.
Absolutely.
And I feel like as you move up the ladder, everything gets toned down to this kind of literary fiction gravitas.
Yeah.
And people are sort of mistaking gravitas for like flat and kind of boring. In my opinion, I agree with you. I don't like that type of thing, and it's a struggle. If I find myself struggling to stay tuned in, something has gone wrong, either with the text or with the delivery. I want to be carried through my walk. I want to be listening. I want to be taking extra laps around the park because
exactly.
I can't fucking turn it off. It's amazing.
Exactly. Exactly. That's how it should be. And let me tell all of our listeners here, if you find Spencer's other audiobooks, they are just as well read as Temba's investigations are.
Thank you very much.
You're in for a treat to do that.
I continue to try to put it all out there. Each project.
And I'm actually kind of amused that you said this about the indie readers now, because as I just told you before we started recording, I have just read my first audiobook myself.
You are an indie audiobook narrator.
So I am an indie, exactly. And I hope to God that I have not been caught up in the flat Danish delivery. I try to do voices. I try to do inflections. But it's actually a little intimidating to know that, you know, I've done this first recording last week. It's a Danish book, which is the one called Lover's Moon in English. They're a short book, but it's still the first time I've read something professionally.
So
quote-unquote.
Exciting. It's so stressful. You know, I know folks generally aren't here for me, but I remember the very first book I did, it did not have any of the, I don't know, pizzazz that a lot of my readings now have. I had no experience. It was done like on a couch in an untreated room right after coronavirus hit. I was living in LA and I couldn't do any other kind of voice work because the studios had all shut down. The only kind of VO work I could do was audiobooks. You are the producer. I don't know if people know that, but nobody goes into studios anymore, or hardly ever, unless you're in New York or LA. But anybody who lives in the flyover states like me, I produce everything. I've treated the room, all that stuff. I bought the mic, and you're just in a box by yourself for however long it takes. And I just, you know, if you listen to that first one compared to, you know, whatever my latest will be by the time this comes out, there is a lot of difference. And I'm, you know, if you keep reading, I'm sure that you also will see a natural progression as you kind of get used to it.
I'm sure I will.
I wish I spoke Danish, because I would love to know how the rhythm is different than English. The rhythm of speech, you know?
It's a little different. There's a lot of Danish that steals from English. Like, we have a lot of different words that we steal from English because we don't have those words. But the beat is different and the pronunciation is different. We have different vowel sounds. So it's different place in your mouth. It's further back in the mouth than the American pronunciation, because also it's right in front of the teeth when you talk in the US, and in Denmark we talk further back in the throat. So our voices sound a little different. But before we take this into a tangent completely, Spencer, we should probably wrap it up for our listeners.
Now, I wanted to ask you if you've got some stuff that you'd like to plug.
Well, as some of you know, if you follow my Instagram and my Facebook, which is my direct source, if you want any news about what I do, you go follow either my profile on Facebook, which is called Klaus Holm Author, or you follow my Instagram, which is called @KlausHolmWriter. But in November, I was at the big giant Danish book fair called Bogforum, and I actually let out of the box that there is going to be a season 4 of Tempest.
Oh, I was going to ask if I could ask you about that. No,
you can
way.
Ask me about that, and it's still in the really early stages. I think I wrote like 40 pages of it. It was because of you, Spencer, I was listening to book 3 after I had. Our readers don't know this, but when Spencer does the book, he sends it over to me and I listen to the entire recording so I can see if there's anything wrong with it.
Which I appreciate.
Anything that's pronounced
just go ahead. Sounds good.
Wrong or anything like that. So I sit and listen to it, but I don't enjoy the book as such. I still get absorbed in it and I still listen to it, the voices, but I have to listen to all the, you
with
know,
a
everything.
Critical ear.
Yeah, but the critical, exactly. When I'm done with that, I will turn it off. And I will sometimes go back a few weeks or a month or 2 months later, and I'll play the book again. But then this time I'll play it for fun. I'll play it to enjoy it. And I did that with book three. I was running through book three here in September, October of last year. Mm. And I was walking around with it, and I was walking around with the characters in my ears talking to me again. And this was the first time in years, because I finished book three in 2020. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time I thought I was done with them.
I don't want to give it, I won't say, but it's a satisfying place to leave.
It's a satisfying conclusion. Yeah. And I figured I want to see, for the first time in these 5 years, I was curious what happened after we wrapped it up, after book three. So I went back and I said, okay, what would happen? How would, do I want to go straight, like from the next day? Or do I want to jump into the action a little bit later? And I actually ended up flashing forward about 6 months after after book three ends.
This is the first teaser.
First teaser. And it's about basically just, it was a story that I had for a long time. I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do an anthology where you'd go back before book one, you'd have a story that took place before book one, but it was just Jim before he met Mercedes.
Yep, yep.
You'd have one in the middle of book two, where Feline is still alive, when there's no, you know, in the middle of the book, and then I'd have a third story that takes place after book three. And that idea sort of grew on me, but I figured I don't really want to go back that far.
Yeah.
So if instead I picked it up after book three, and I said, this is what's going to happen to the characters next, and then there's going to be a flashback to something that happened years and years and years before.
I wish I could. Yeah, so okay.
Mm-hmm. That's what's going to happen in the book. It's going to be basically two stories in it. Ooh. That's my hope, at least. The main story, and then the flashback to what happened earlier. Why are we in this position now? Oh, something happened a couple of years ago, way before this all started.
Wow.
This is why the characters are you know, in the position
facing
they are
this
now.
Thing. I should say to the listeners, I know as much as you all do, which is not a thing, except that it's a possibility. I don't know who's on the page. I don't know who the narrative follows. And I don't want to know until it's ready.
And I'm also not going to say I cannot promise when this is going to be out, because it took me a year to write the each other Tempest book. And that was without anything else, doing just one project. Because I work full time as well as being a rather prolific author at this point.
Yeah, for real. You're
putting
them out.
I don't have the time to sit down and write it right now, because I'm doing edits and writing book part two of a Danish pirate novel that I've been working on for the last year and a half.
I wish some of these will some of these make it into English?
Some of these might make the person that I'm writing the pirate books, which we right now refer to as Crossed Blades. They might be translated, because my co-writer is actually she's a translator in English. So she might take it upon herself to finish it afterwards and translate them. Who knows? It depends on so much. It is such a big project to translate a book.
Yeah,
but I'm doing it on the sort of on the side of doing those projects. I'm doing Tempest 4, which is actually I think I took this to Instagram as well, but I'm going to tell you now as well. It's called, in my mind right now, it's called Tempest Investigations Season of the Witch.
I love that. I'm into that.
So it's actually not going to be season 4. I just call it that sort of as a shorthand, but it's not going to be season 4. It's going to be a special.
that happens pretty frequently with shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it's not going to be a whole series like the other ones. It's not going to be 4 or 5 or 6 different chapters in it. It's going to be a special.
Oh, I kind of dig that. It puts some, takes some pressure off of you too, to produce like, okay, this has to be in the same vein and better than seasons 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
This is a different animal.
This is different animal. Yeah.
And it's fresh for the viewers, for the readers, viewers, and listeners as well.
This was, yeah, this was actually also my idea, was that you should be able to pick up this book, this new book, Season of the Witch. You should pick that up if you want and start there.
Yeah.
Completely. If you haven't read any of the other three, you should still be able to say, okay, I'll start right here.
Well, I can't wait to read it. If it's, you know, well, I won't put a lot of pressure on you. I know that that would not, it's not fun to write when everybody's like, come on, dude.
it'll come out when it's good
it'll
and ready.
Come but out when it's ready. You got a lot of on your plate as it is.
But I know that there's people out there for, there's a demand for it. And I know that there have been people contacting me and saying, oh, we really want you to do more with these characters. And now I can say, yes, there will be something more with these characters. I promise you that.
I love to leave it there. I want to say thanks to everybody who's been listening to our seasons in podcast form. If some of them are for sale, if you're listening to this and you absolutely can't wait, the copies of the audiobook are up on the Zon as well. You can get a jump start and you can listen to season 3 right now. Please also go check out everything that Klaus has done. We'll put your socials and stuff in the show notes. Follow. Don't be shy about any sort of fan work. I would love to read some more of that out loud.
Absolutely.
Please send those in. And yeah, thanks so much, everyone, for all your support. Klaus, any last words?
Thank you for listening. Really, I would appreciate it.
All right, you all. Be well, and we will see you in season 3. Rhea in Paris, a Tempest Investigations fan fiction written by Benedicta Grandal. The Louvre Museum was closing for the evening, and the last of the guests headed toward the exits. Several security guards stood by the doors, checking people as they left and making a head count of how many were leaving against how many had entered earlier in the day. As the halls slowly emptied, one of the last guests to leave was a young woman with dark hair, clad in a leather jacket. She had been wearing sunglasses, even as she walked around inside the museum, and kept them on as she walked out into the afternoon's soft light. She didn't know if the Louvre had facial scanners as a part of their security systems, and she didn't want to take the risk of being recognized. She had wanted to enjoy the museum in peace and find a spot where she could enter without risk later. The doors shut behind the last visitors, and people began walking away from the museum and the glass pyramid in front of it. Many of them headed to the Tuileries Park next to the palace to spend some time by the fountains and enjoy the last hours of sunshine. Rhea checked her phone. She had photographed the painting she planned on collecting later in the night and sent it to her client to be absolutely sure it was what he wanted. Now, a reply had come back. That's the one. With a smile, she headed towards the outer edge of the palace to find a cafe. She would need to kill a few hours before going into action. Inside the museum, the lights were turned to low, and the guards activated all the security systems that kept this huge museum safe at night. Some of the rooms had motion detectors and temperature sensors that would instantly alert the guards on duty of any intruders. Other rooms had even more advanced security, which was only turned on at night. Lasers and self-sealing doors were just a few of the measures, which made the Louvre one of the safest museums in France, perhaps the world. To steal something from the Louvre was thought to be next to impossible. Rhea had crepes and coffee at a cafe as she waited for night to fall over Paris. The mini lights along the River Seine began to come on while she read a French newspaper. A lot more cars filled the roads for a while as rush hour came and went. Finally, when darkness had fallen, she paid her bill, went to the bathroom to change into the black outfit she used when working. After changing, she left the cafe. She walked down a quiet side street and found a dark opening into a courtyard, where she closed her eyes and teleported into the Louvre Museum itself in the blink of an eye. She had picked a corner of one of the large galleries, where there were no censors to give her away, and when she appeared again, she had to stand for a while and let her eyes adjust to the low light. She reached into her backpack and brought out an aerosol can. When she pushed it, a faint blue smoke came out and filled the air in the gallery. She could see no laser beams, but she knew they were in some of the rooms. She didn't think the room her painting was displayed in had any either, but you had to be careful. She walked slowly down the corridor towards the room where the painting she was here for was displayed. She was glad her buyer hadn't wanted her to steal the Mona Lisa. That painting was protected by even more security because it had already been stolen once. When she came to the room she wanted, she sprayed the blue mist again, and this time she could see three laser beams crossing the room just inside the door. If she had walked right in, she would have set off the alarms, and the big metal gates in the ceiling would have come crashing down. Of course, she could just teleport out. No cage could hold her. But she didn't want people to be alerted to her presence until tomorrow. She had a flight out of the country late tonight, and she wanted the painting far away before anyone knew it was gone. Instead of crawling under the lasers, she concentrated and teleported past them, appearing on the other side of the room. It was so easy, she almost laughed out loud. She stood for a moment and looked at the painting her buyer wanted, Vermeer's The Lace Maker. Not a particularly famous painting, but the man who had contacted her had told her it had a very special meaning to him because he had seen it as a child and always wanted it for himself. He thought the woman in the painting was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. Rhea thought she looked sort of old-fashioned, but then she wasn't picking up a picture to hang in her own living room. This was for a client, and her own taste didn't matter. She positioned herself in a corner so any camera that was turned on in the room wouldn't see her, and got ready. She knew she couldn't touch the frames of the painting without setting off the alarm, so she had to do something much more complicated. She reached into her backpack again and pulled out a special pair of glasses. They were almost like binoculars and could help her zoom in on very small details. She looked at the painting in the frame and began using her telekinetic power to pull out the tiny little nails that held the picture in place inside the frame. One by one by one, they came loose, so the canvas itself was no longer framed, and with her mind, she lifted the painting very gently out and over to her, leaving the frame where it was. It wasn't a large painting, but big enough that she had to hold it in front of her while gently rolling it up into a tube. She looked at the now empty frame. No alarm had gone off, so she had done it. She was the best thief in the world, and she had proven it again. She didn't want to return to the place she had teleported in, and she didn't need to. She could easily remember the little courtyard she'd stood in before. And when she closed her eyes, she teleported out of the Louvre and back into the night, without anyone noticing she was even there. When she appeared in the courtyard, she didn't stay more than a moment before teleporting back to her hotel room a few streets away. Here, she put on her normal clothes and packed the painting into her suitcase. It was a little risky, but she couldn't carry it on board the plane in her carry-on baggage. She closed the suitcase and went down into the lobby. While she checked out and asked the man at the counter to call her a taxi to the airport, she sent a text. Painting is secure. Transfer money to my account before flight at 10, or I put it back. She hadn't even made it around the corner in the taxi before her phone told her she was now $1 million richer. She smiled and leaned back in the seat while the taxi drove her out of Paris. When she handed the painting over to the buyer, it was time to go back to San Francisco and see Jim again. The Lurking Cat, a Tempest Investigations side story written by Klaus Holm. This story takes place between We Need a Tempest Christmas and Clash of the Titans. Feline came down the stairs from her afternoon nap in the living room on the second floor. She rubbed her eyes with one hand and held her phone in the other. Her sharp ears picked up chatter from the kitchen, and she stopped as she heard her name being mentioned. She cocked her head, listening more intently.
"Going to know if we do it," Andrew's voice said.
"She'll never know," Mercedes said. "She's asleep upstairs right now. She sleeps so many hours a day, we could all eat for hours and she'd never notice."
"She might, though, and she can't know."
Jim's voice was muffled, and she could tell that he was smoking a cigarette.
"I think she'd notice it if you were gone, Picard. I think it should be Mercedes. She doesn't live here. It's easier to explain her being gone."
Feline's brow furrowed. Being gone? Why would Mercedes or any of them be gone? What was going on?
"But none of you tell her anything, even if she asks," Andrew continued.
"If you do, well, the cat's out of the bag, so to speak."
"My lips are sealed."
Mercedes sounded very convinced.
"Where did you put all this stuff?"
"Jim's office," Andrew said.
"She doesn't like to be in there because of the smell of smoke."
"Look, it's my office. I'll smoke if I want to," Jim said.
"Yes, and right now, it's actually a good thing.
She won't go looking for it," Andrew said.
"Okay, Mercedes. If you're going, go.
Oh, and we're probably going to need some good, strong string or something. Something that won't break. Will you get that while you're out?"
"Sure, sure," Mercedes said.
"You're sure you don't need, like, steel wire or something?"
"No, string should be enough. She's not going to break it," Andrew said.
Feline felt a shiver down her back. String? Break it? Were they talking about tying her up? Like some of the pets she'd seen humans have? Well, that would be the day, she thought. She'd break any string they put on her.
She heard Mercedes' steps walk across the kitchen.
Quickly and soundlessly, she stepped up the stairs again, hiding in the afternoon shadows of the stairwell. Mercedes didn't notice her as she walked past and headed for the front door. Feline could hear Jim and Andrew in the kitchen, but she had other fish to fry. Curiosity made her walk quietly to the door of Jim's office and step inside. The room was stuffy, since none of the windows were open, and the smell of Jim's cigarettes hung in the air. She looked around the room, which was full of books and knick-knacks on several bookshelves, the couch and chairs around a coffee table, and, of course, Jim's desk. But what was she looking for? She didn't know if it was something big, something small, old, or new, just that she wasn't supposed to find it, which meant she absolutely had to find it. It could be something dangerous. They had talked about tying her up. What could that have kept from her? A collar? She supposed it wouldn't be so bad with a collar if it had diamonds on it, but she didn't want to be treated like a normal animal. She was, truth be told, quite sad that Andrew would act like this. She decided to start with the desk, opening the drawers one by one. They were filled with more of Jim's old souvenirs and odd stuff, and she went through it without knowing what half of it was. A crystal ball, a plastic card, a red key. It was all junk to her. She went through all the drawers and found nothing that would constitute anything to be used against her. Suddenly, she perked her ears.
"Let me just get my hat,"
Jim's voice said as he exited the kitchen.
"I gotta get some more smokes before we do this."
Feline looked first at the hat, which was hanging on a rack on the wall, just above her head, and then at the door to the room. In a second or two, Jim would walk through the door, and he would know she'd been rifling through his stuff. She made a leap for the empty spot under the desk, pushed the chair out of the way, and squeezed inside it. She made herself as small as possible as the door opened, and Jim stepped into the office. He was whistling and grabbed his fedora off the rack, putting it on his head. Feline tried not to make a sound, but the spot under the table was dusty, and she could tell that she was about to sneeze. She squeezed her nose shut, held her breath, and forced herself not to sneeze as Jim crossed the room and went into the lobby, leaving both doors open. Even if she sneezed now, he would hear her, she thought. She could barely hold on, and her face got redder and redder, her nose tickling worse than when she had taken a sniff in the pepper grinder a few weeks ago. As soon as she heard the door close behind Jim, she sneezed and immediately regretted it. Where was Andrew? He could still hear her. She crawled out from under the desk and looked at the rest of the room. There was no way she could search this room and expect to find anything. Except... Her eyes fell on a black bag tucked into the corner behind the couch. It looked like a trash bag, but there was something inside it, only she couldn't tell what. She walked over and was about to reach out and touch the bag when Andrew's voice came from the lobby.
Feline, are you here?
She mentally cursed. If she answered, he would know she was in here, and both the door to the back hall and the one to the lobby was open. It would be hard to get out without him seeing her. Her eyes fell on the window. The office lay under the living room. Perhaps she could climb out the window, up the wall, and into the living room, and he'd think she was there all along? No, she decided. If she did that, the whole street would see her do it, and there would be questions. Instead, she waited until she heard Andrew's steps go out of the lobby into the back corridor, and then followed him as quietly as a lion stalking a gazelle. She crept very slowly back towards the back hall as Andrew now went into the office. She raced for the stairs and took them in quick, silent steps. When she reached the second floor, she stopped and looked back. He wouldn't know she'd even been downstairs. What was truly going on here? Were her friends really planning some kind of nefarious scheme? She couldn't believe that, especially not Andrew. Things had been going so well for them, and she liked him. She couldn't believe he'd want to tie her up. But he had said to get string she couldn't break. She heard the front door slam and Jim coming back in. He had apparently just been to the corner store and back. "She's not answering," Andrew's voice said downstairs. "So I think she's still sleeping in the living room. Okay, let's set up until Mercedes gets back. Shouldn't be long." Feline could hear them go into the office and then back to the kitchen, but she didn't dare poke her head around the stairway and see what they were doing. She was stuck up here. She made a frustrated little sound and almost stomped her foot before realizing that they would probably hear her doing that. She made up her mind. She would get out of the house. If they truly wanted to do something bad to her, she would have a better chance of fighting them if she was outside and could take her larger werecat shape. She went into the bathroom, which had a window facing the backyard, and opened it. She could easily jump that far, she estimated, looking down. Then she could wait outside until they were ready to reveal what the hell they were up to. She swung her leg over the windowsill and perched on it, then jumped. She landed gracefully on the grass in the backyard, next to Andrew's motorcycle. She looked at the kitchen window and could see them inside doing... What were they doing? Putting some sort of paper letters up over the window? Why would they do that? And what did it say? She couldn't read backwards and could only see a couple of the letters. She heard a car door slam out front and figured it was Mercedes coming back. Now, it probably wouldn't be long before this little drama came to an end.
Okay, I got it, she heard Mercedes say inside. Here's the string you wanted, and I'll just put this here. You got a knife, Jim?
Right here, Jim replied.
A knife? They were going to attack her with a knife. She felt tears sting her eyes. She had not expected that from Andrew, from any of them, really.
There, Andrew's voice said. It's up. Let's get her.
They began to call her name inside the house. She pulled herself together, raised her voice, and called,
I'm out here. If you want me, you'll have to come out here and get me.
It took a few seconds before the back door opened and the other three members of the Tempest team came out.
What are you doing out here? Andrew asked.
Waiting for you to tie me up and cut me with a knife, Feline said.
Her eyes had begun to shine bright green as she prepared to change shape.
But you're not getting me without a fight.
A fight? Andrew raised his hands.
Whoa! Nobody wants to fight you, Feline. And what do you mean, tie you up?
You bought string I couldn't break.
And a knife, too.
Feline's voice tapered off as she watched the faces of her three friends show first puzzlement, then laughter.
Do you know what my mother always told me, chica?
Mercedes said.
People who listen at keyholes rarely hear what they like. You've been listening to us, haven't you?
What?
Not at a keyhole, Feline said. I just hear better than you. You know that.
So, you're not going to tie me up?
Of course not. Jim held out his hand. Come on in and see what we've set up in here.
Feline took a few steps closer to the back door and looked into the kitchen. On the table was a cake, with a cartoon cat saying, I'm the coolest cat in town. On the walls were paper letters on strings spelling Happy Birthday. And on the end wall was a large handmade sign hung up by string. It said, Happy Birthday, Feline. We all love you.
Birthday? Feline said.
But
Mr. Darcy told us that today was the day he turned you human for the first time, Andrew said.
So we figured it's your birthday. We wanted to celebrate, since he said he'd never done so for you before.
Feline now felt her eyes sting with tears. She blinked them back. She almost never cried, and didn't want to do so now.
You all did this for me?
She asked, taking a few steps into the kitchen and smelling the cake.
We did, Jim said. And we've got presents for you as well. That's traditional at a human birthday.
Yes, I know that, Feline said. I've seen movies, you know.
Jim picked up the big trash bag, reached into it, and pulled out three packages. He put them on the table.
Why don't you open them, and then we'll have cake.
Feline picked up the first package.
That's from me,
Mercedes said. When she tore the paper off, she saw a makeup kit from Kohl's put in a fancy box.
Charlie got it for me, Mercedes said. It's supposed to be the best.
Feline went for the second package when Andrew nudged her.
Traditionally, one says thank you when one receives a present.
Oh, right.
Thank you, Feline said, already focused on the next package.
This one's from me, Jim said. I'm not really good with presents, but,
When the paper came off, Feline saw it was a new smartphone. It had a bigger screen and a better camera than the one she had.
Thank you, she said, this time actually looking at Jim. I wanted this.
I figured as much, Jim said.
The last one is from me, Andrew said. He pointed to a smaller box, which was unwrapped and heart-shaped. Feline opened it and almost lost her breath. A small necklace with a tiny gold heart in it.
Thank you, she mumbled.
She picked the necklace up.
This isn't Tiffany's diamonds or anything, Andrew said. My salary isn't high enough for that. But I thought I saw you look at this one at Christmas in Kohl's.
I did, Feline handed it to him. Put it on me.
Andrew did so with a smile. Feline looked at her reflection in the window.
I'm beautiful, she said, touching the necklace.
Yes, you are, Andrew said, and gave her a kiss.
And on that note, Jim said, let's have some cake. I have been waiting for this all day.
They sat down around the kitchen table, and as Jim cut the cake, Feline took a deep breath. This was probably one of the best moments in her life, and she felt silly for thinking they would ever have hurt her. She wanted to stay with them for as long as she lived.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax? Dax?
Sorry, did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.